Hello and welcome to the Fox Football Podcast Monday edition. What a weekend of football it's been. Can't wait to rip through all of it from home and abroad. Alongside me as always to do so is Simon Hill.
Good to see you, Garby. How are you?
A little bit tired, to be honest. The Premier League
watching
got me
your
last
boys.
I was up all night. I couldn't tear myself away.
They're doing well, aren't they? They'll finish second this year.
Yeah, but the North London Derby as well was brilliant. Very funny. We'll get into that later on. But the North London Derby as well was brilliant. So, yeah, I was up till about 4:30 a.m. But I'm fired up for the podcast regardless, and great to have a special guest with us, as is pretty much the case every week now. The rotating third chair has had some great names in it. We've got another one today.
Biggest name today.
Yeah, you'd say so. A long time listener, first time caller into the podcast, Daniel McBreen. Welcome.
Right. Wearing the mankini as well. Fantastic.
Yeah. Nice weather for it, so I thought I'd get it on today.
We'll get onto that a little bit later because one of our viewers has asked about that in the questions segment. So we'll tuck into that later on along with some other good submissions. Thank you for all of those. The moustache is gone. You got rid of that on shootout last night. How's it feeling?
It's feeling fresh, actually. It was a very bad moustache for a very good cause, and I was very glad to get rid of it in the end.
Keen to get all your views on everything that's gone on in the weekend and the season to date. Great to have you on the podcast for the first time, debut. And you've been doing some interesting things recently, Macca. You've been coaching Guam.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting project. Tell us about that before we get into the weekend action.
Yeah, look, ex-teammate of mine and good guy all around, I guess, Carl Dodd. He's ex-strength and conditioning coach from the Jets and Brisbane Roar as well. Left there and then went to be TD for Western Pride. And while he was there, after a couple of years there, someone said he should apply for this position as head coach of the Guam national team. Lo and behold, he got the job, and obviously we've been keeping in touch for quite a while, and asked me if I'd like to be involved and assist him. So he spends his whole time, he's over on Guam full time as a head coach over there. And when we have camps with the national team, which we've had two in Japan recently, asked me and myself and a couple of other guys, Australian guys, Matt Hamm as the goalkeeping coach and strength and conditioning as well, if we'd like to join him. And it's been really great. Yeah, we've had two camps trying to get a new philosophy, a new culture through. It's short camps, 10 days, 2 weeks. So it's really interesting. It's very intense. And very enjoyable.
Guam have had some good results over the last few years. I remember there was an English guy, Gary White, who used to be the national team coach, and rose them a long way in the rankings. What's the standard like these days?
Yeah, look, it's probably not when you go into like a Socceroos camp. It's probably a more consistent base of the players, the standard through the squad. We've got quite a mix of players from really young guys who are 16 from the island all the way through to guys who are playing in the USL, etc.
Are they expats?
Yes.
Dipping into the diaspora like a lot of countries these days?
Yeah. So those guys in America sort of probably, but we're trying to get that belief from the local guys. They really look up to those guys who go over to America and play in the USL, but trying to get that, bond and belief between the two different dimensions there, and that these younger guys can aspire to be there or can be as good as those guys, if not better. So trying to get up that group dynamic as one whole and working together, it's really interesting work.
So are you going around the A-League now and saying, have you got any Guam in you?
Yeah, we're going around everywhere, actually. We're searching to every corner of the earth at the moment to try and find more players.
Some Guamish Martin Boyles or...
Yeah.
Players of that ilk.
Yeah, someone who's never been there before but can do the job for us.
Guamish. Is that right?
I don't know.
It sounds like Guamish.
Yeah, well, Guamanian.
Guamanian.
Is that
right? That's the correct term, is it?
Right.
And you're pretty keen to make it as a coach. Has this sort of got you going in that direction again?
Yeah, look, I've spent the last 3 years in the Jets Academy. Mm. Really enjoyed my time there, and this was just another dimension. I want to eventually coach at the highest level as I can, and this was a great opportunity to go with Carl. And look, Carl's very, very thorough. He's very professional, he's a couple of years younger than me, but I'm learning a lot from him because he's had that experience in the A-League, first in the A-League, then as a TD in the NPL in Australia, and now as a head coach of an international. So to go with him, although we've been friends for a long time, I'm learning a lot from him as well. So it's really good environment to be in, that very professional environment, and I think the players are really relishing that as well.
Interesting stuff. You've been keeping abreast of everything in the A-League, though, that is for sure, and there was a performance on Saturday night that had us all excited.
Toivonen wants it early. Barbarossa's finds him. What a ball. And Tonis! Oh, wow! Have you seen prettier football than that? one touch, fluent movement.
Don't think we've seen prettier football than that in terms of that goal, and certainly not in terms of the performance all season long and maybe for a while. Say what you like about the Wanderers and how poor they were. The victory were simply delightful on Saturday night. And, yeah, they just reminded us all of, you know, you can talk about the glory all you like of the benchmark in this league, and I think they are most certainly that.
There's no doubt about that. I thought that was the best performance by any team that I've seen so far this season. No qualms in saying that. No qualms. I thought Keisuke Honda was terrific throughout. And that combination that he's sort of finding with Antonis and several others. And also his post-game interview, which was brilliant with Zappa, you know, saying that he wasn't satisfied and that they still wanted more. You know, this is why Victory are the benchmark club. Let's be honest. They didn't have their best season last year, if we're being brutally honest about it, even though they ended up as champions. There were lots of ups and downs, and I think Kevin Muscat has addressed most of those. All right, they lost the first two games of the season, but Muscat was at pains to say, look, it's going to take a little while for us all to check. And they didn't play badly in those two games that they lost, and now they're absolutely flying. I think it's going to take a very good team to stop them. Maybe only Perth can do that.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Like you said, losing those first two games, a little bit of question marks start to come over them. But I agree. I don't think they played bad in those games. And we're starting to see the fruits of this experience of Honda and Toivonen. Barbarouskas, for me, has been absolutely amazing this season. Antonis, for me, again, is a player probably in career best form or coming to it, because he's been bubbling along and had moments, but now we're starting to see that consistency of week in, week out. So they were just dynamic going forward. It was frightening for me. I'm a striker, obviously, so I watched the front two. It was a classic little and large, obviously in size difference, but Barbarouskas and those runs that were coming in between the fullbacks and the centre backs and dragging players out of position. And then when he was dragged on the one side, Toivonen would do the same on the other side. The movement they did to create and pull defenders out of positions, pull fullbacks back, that then created space for midfield players. And then you've got players like Honda and Boehner to get on the ball. It was exceptional and it was a joy to watch.
And don't forget, no Troisi, no Niedermeyer, Kenny Athews still to come back to put a bit of pressure on Toivonen and Barbarouskas up top. They're looking pretty good.
I had someone message me on Twitter afterwards, and I reckon it was a great point. He said this Victory team would finish mid-table in the Eredivisie in Holland. And I tell you what, at its best, it's not a bad shout. When you look at Toivonen, Honda, Troisi back to his best form, Antonis in the form that he's in.
Yeah.
Carl Valeri's gone to a new level this season. He was probably underwhelming by his own standards last season. I reckon a guy like Honda's made him lift his game. And then the defensive players we speak about, I mean, Thomas Deng is an up-and-coming player, wow, in the Socceroos squad. So, yeah.
I wonder if fans of Fortuna Sittard or Twente Enschede sit there going, you know what, if we were in the A-League, we'd finish top four. it's our cultural cringe, isn't it?
Yeah.
They don't do that.
No.
But nobody,
you know,
does it.
No, but I think that Honda has that effect, you know, the standards. And I was talking to someone upstairs before I came down. I said, every time I've been in a club where we've been successful, that culture has been through the club of when you're 3-0 up, you don't turn off and just go, okay, let's just go through the motions and just see the game out. It's no, let's get 4, let's get 5, let's get 6. And everybody's driving that. And you can see that that's what this team is, especially with Honda, is all about.
And also the fact that Honda was aware enough, he normally takes the penalties.
Yeah.
He was aware
yeah.
enough that Costa hadn't scored this season and needed a goal. So he was happy to and confident enough in his ability to be able to say, go on, you take the penalty, get yourself a
and
goal.
And Kevin Muscat's confident enough to let Honda make those decisions.
Yeah.
Normally a coach would say, hey, what are you doing? Honda, you take it. We're not, you know. But he's allowing the experienced player to have a lot of leadership in that regard. And Mark Bosnich made the point on Bill and Boz last night. He's managed these big personalities really well at the start of the season.
Yep.
Toivonen's a huge player. I mean, he just scored for Sweden at the World Cup. The way he's just eased him in, he's not trying to change too much, just do your thing. And the same with Honda. Was lucky enough to spend some time with Kev around the Socceroos game in Brisbane, and he said the way that Honda prepares is just unbelievable. I mean, he's training and all that, but the way he looks after himself, he weighs every meal that he has, weighs it. I mean, if that's not a lesson for the young players coming through at the Victory of how to apply yourself to make it to the top, I don't know what it is. So
I do that too, don't you? Extra heavy. No, it's not enough.
Not enough. More sauce, more aioli, more chicken, please. So, yeah, absolutely brilliant. But as good as they were, the Wanderers were poor. Are we concerned about Marcus Babbel's project in these early stages?
To be honest, a little bit, yes. He said it after the game. It was like men against boys. And if you look at that midfield, you could probably see a point there. You've got Bomjohan, who is the playmaker. You know, you want him to get on the ball and play, create the play and play those silky balls. You had Backus and O'Doherty, two young boys in the midfield. Already they're outnumbered with the four against Victory. But you look at Victory's midfield and you look at experience. As you say, you've got Valeri, you've got Baena, you've got Honda. They're all class players. And then you've got Antonis, who's playing well as well. So it is almost exactly that. Men against boys, that young. They're really young, inexperienced players that you are wanting to try and dominate a midfield. And you look at their squad and you think, well, who are they going to bring into those positions? And if I'm looking at that, I'm like, well, who have they got else in that position? Maybe Mahazi is the only other player. And how old is he? Mm. He's another young boy as well. So,
well, he's 26, but he had a year out of the game, didn't he? But, I mean, with respect to Rashid, he wasn't a regular in the Victory first team when he was
That experience factor sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think,
where's Patrick Ziegler, by the way?
He's been injured.
I know he had knee surgery, but I was told it was like a couple of weeks thing.
He was named in the squad this week for the first time, but didn't come up.
So I think that's an issue.
It might be okay for Friday night.
No disrespect to Tariq Elrich, who does a good job, you know, filling in, but it's not his natural position. Yeah. I think Ziegler, they need to get back alongside Hamill and move, Tariq back into one of the full-back, but, well, probably the left-back, because obviously Josh Risden is at right-back. But you're right, that midfield area is a concern. They've got five out of their next six at home, and I say at home in inverted commas because, of course, we don't know where home is for Wanderers these days. That's going to be crucial to their season. I mean, they've got to start getting points on the board to inject a bit of confidence into that squad. It's very difficult for them being away from Parramatta. Very difficult. They've lost all that massive advantage that they had at Pirtek Stadium. And that defence is just very leaky. Only the Mariners have conceded more goals than
massive game now on Friday night, Western Sydney against the Mariners. I mean, that's big for both. The loser of that, Mulvey or Babel, the pressure is coming big style. So, and especially for Western Sydney, considering their status and what you expect from them, that's a huge game for Marcus on Friday night. So a big subplot going into that one. Can't wait for it. The Battle of Hindmarsh on Friday. Geez, we thought Mundine Horn would be the big fight on Friday night. We thought this was a nice entree to it. It ended up being better than the River City battle because that was over in about 60 seconds. What a fizzer. But, geez, it got a bit ugly between Marco Kurz and John Aloisi and obviously some of the players, including Stephen Mork and Jordan Elsie, and Isaias was the saviour of it all. But I quite liked it, the drama. It was enthralling.
I have to agree. I thought it was a fantastic game. It had everything you wanted. It was open, flowing. There was a chances galore. Heated moments. You could show that it really meant something to the players. It wasn't just like, oh, yeah, another humdrum. It was full on, and it was gripping to watch. And the sideline drama added to it, which was great. But what I liked about that was but at the end of the game, both of them shook hands and said, look, misunderstanding, game's finished, and that's done. But
it was mature, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And there was nothing else after it. So that was great. But, yeah, what a game that was. It was... You couldn't turn it off. Yeah. Like, there was no way you were going to get a drink. It was, I'm waiting for half time. It was fantastic.
Loved it. Loved to call it. It was just really edge of the seat stuff.
And high quality football.
It was. Yeah. But also, you didn't quite know what was going to happen next because you could tell it was on the edge. And when Stephen Mork came off the bench, we know that he's ex-Adelaide, born in Adelaide, and there's been a bit of history between the two clubs. Aloisi and Kurtz have, you know, we saw the shots pre-game, Kurtz celebrating, spraying the water, and then Aloisi returning fire the season before. I thought it was fantastic stuff, and we need more of that type of game. Not necessarily the over-physicality in places, but we need that intensity. I thought that was absolutely compelling viewing, and you can tell by the conversation that it started afterwards how much people enjoyed it and became, you know, riveted to it. There's a couple of question marks for me. First of all, the red card, or the second yellow to Taylor Regan. The VAR got involved in that, didn't it? How can the VAR then say it's a yellow card? I thought they could only get involved for straight reds.
Maybe they said, have a look at the hand in the face.
But for a straight red,
but then he must have thought, well, that's just for me, I'll just give a second yellow. That might have been his decision on the pitch.
But are you allowed to... I'm a little bit confused by that. Are you allowed to issue just a second yellow on the evidence of the VAR? I thought the VAR was only to say, you've got to send him off. Or the decision stands.
Yeah. I didn't think
which
the VAR...
Which was a yellow in the first instance.
Do we know exactly what the yellow was for?
No.
It was. I didn't think
he'd
was,
already been booked. Hadn't
he booked. Got a second yellow and was a red, wasn't it?
I thought it was a straight red. He got. Was it or not?
No.
No.
Regan got a second. Right. Stephen Mort got a straight red.
Yes. Sorry. So what was the did after the game? Did we find out exactly what the second yellow was for? Because was it for Taylor Regan comes in, does the foul, and as he's running back, he clashes with the Adelaide player.
That's a Brisbane player.
Brisbane player.
Wenzel Halls.
Yes.
He sticks the knot in ever so slightly.
As they ran across, he kicked legs with someone first, and that's when they all ran in. So was it for the little lash out with the kick, or was it for the hand in the face? I don't know.
But whatever it's for, the point I'm trying to make here is that if the VAR is getting involved, then it can only be to issue the red card.
Yeah.
And the referee only issued a yellow, which, okay, was enough to send him off because he's already been booked. But the point remains that you can't just issue a yellow on the evidence of VAR, can you?
Well, isn't it the same as if a linesman, a referee goes to his assistant on the sideline and they discuss it and he says, well, I thought it was a red card. And he says, no, from my angle, it was a yellow. So he has his own decision at the end.
No, absolutely.
So isn't that the same with the VAR?
No, not my understanding.
That he can make the final decision?
I thought it was only, they could only get involved for direct red cards, penalties, mistaken identity. Mm. What's the other one? Offside.
Offside, yeah.
Those are the only four categories as far as I... Anyway, look, it's a moot point because he was sent off anyway. Mm. But, again, I think it sort of adds to the confusion over VAR, which I'm sure we're going to come on to later.
Speaking of yellow cards, Adam Taggart got the most bizarre one of the season today when he rolled back on the pitch. But
it was actually very smart.
Well, yeah,
he took one for the team.
It was cheeky. Yeah. Although I don't think he wanted to. The physio said go and do it. He had to cop the yellow. And if he was right to go on.
They were defending a corner.
If he was right to play on, I think he would have given the physio a serve and said, what did you do that for, mate? Now I've copped the yellow. But of course, his mind was somewhere else, probably in regards to having his Socceroos dreams dashed because he was building towards that Adam Taggart. And now it seems, even if he's back in a couple of weeks, he won't have enough to win over Graham Arnold in his credit bank. So that's a big concern for him and for Brisbane, obviously.
I actually found it a bit strange that when he originally came off and you could see he had his problem with it and he went back on, straight away alarm bells were ringing for me there. I thought, well, if you've got a little tweak, all it takes is for one strike of the ball. And I think it was when he had that strike that he did it. And I just thought, why would you risk that? I know you want to try and push yourself as far, but if you feel that tweak, especially in the groin area, that's not...
Whose call is that though, Macca? Is that the players or the coach?
Well, I guess it would be his. I think the physio would say, he'd ask him how it is, and then he'd say, no, I think I'm all right, I can get on with it. But you've got to have these things in the back of your mind. Like, are you going to miss this game and be potentially right for next week, or do I push it and then maybe be out for three or 4 weeks? Mm. I know what, as a player and as a coach, you'd want is that, okay, well, let's mitigate the risk and just bring him off now. It's a tough one.
Craig Goodwin looked really good. I was watching that game and I was thinking, geez, we did our Socceroos 11s. I reckon Craig Goodwin should be in mind. The form he's in. And then you think, oh, maybe Chris Economides, the way he's going for Perth, he contributes the equaliser. And then you see Owen Mabil scored overnight yet again for Midtjylland in Denmark. So there's so many options in that area.
Ben Halloran.
And Ben Halloran, who knows, maybe he'd be... Well, the old cliche, a bit of a bolter. But, geez, he's coming to some form and he's giving them that goal-scoring option, which they've obviously been rotating through.
He has. I think Adelaide are looking a lot more potent. They seem to have found the solutions for the time being to that goal-scoring issue. Ken Elso didn't score at the weekend, but he led the line reasonably well. Obviously, they still have Diawara to come back and Blackwood ultimately. Interesting that I saw Bruce Gittay on the couch on Fox Sunday night, and he said, I'm not going to give anything away. No scoop, he said, about his future, but he was talking to some people. I wonder if he's talking to the Reds, because he would be ideal for them.
Well, I even asked him off camera, and he still said, I've got nothing to tell you. So I tried to get the scoop off camera, but he wouldn't give it.
Good on you, Brucey. What about Gosford on Saturday afternoon? We'll get into the game in a moment, but the moon-booted pitch invader, who, as we saw, it was funny at the time, but as we saw in shootout last night, it was actually a bit disturbing as he tried to throw some haymakers towards the security. I mean, his head was in a place it shouldn't be, but that was a little bit worrying.
Like
for
you say, it looked like all fun and games at first, and you thought, and he seemed like he was being, in the moment, happy, and then all of a sudden it just turned very sinister, and he went from being a funny joke to something that was pretty bloody stupid, if I'm honest. And reports sort of at the end of the game were that he also had done something to a security guard before he got out there. So it could have been, well, it was very stupid. And, yeah, it sort of asked questions of the security as well, like how, you know, a guy on crutches in a moon boot can manage to walk basically with no one stopping him to just stand on the six-yard box.
One of the most surreal moments, I think, of my A-League commentary career, when you see a pitch invade and you look at him and think, how on earth has he got there? And you're right. Initially, you thought it was just good humour, but it did turn a little bit nasty. A man wearing a Cricket Australia shirt with rugby league shorts, a moon boot and crutches, and then throws his crutches away, has a pop at security. Police are called. His wife then, or his girlfriend, then apparently came down and started getting involved as well. It just utterly surreal. Mm. And I know that the Mariners are irritated by it because they're not in control of security on match day at the stadium. That's the local council. They own the stadium. They mm-hmm. run the stadium. The Mariners would love to have management rights of the stadium. They can't get it or they can't agree to it, whatever. So, you know, it makes them look bad and it's not actually their fault. Whoever that idiot was, they should, you know, ban him from the stadium for the next 5 years. They should be able to spot him, let's be honest, at least for the next few months anyway.
From the surreal to the sensational, though, and Brandon O'Neill's goal was just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Has he, I mean, we shouldn't be comparing the two because they work together, but has he gone past Josh Brolante for now, do you think? I think he might
He can score goals.
Yeah, I think on form this season, he's doing a bit more than Josh. He sort of, Brandon was the second banana to Josh in midfield for a while.
Yeah, look, I think he's been exceptional for the last 3 or 4 years. Like, he's a fantastic player. He has that extra element in his game with free kicks and strikes on goal that he can score those goals as well. But Mariners, again, they just stayed off him, didn't they? They sort of invited him. And I was at that game on pitch side, and it was very windy going that direction. And sat there on the sideline with Glenn Lauder saying, this is going to be a game of two halves because all the wind is that old park football. Oh, we'll play with the wind and against the wind. And we knew second half that Sydney would get more of the play because they'd be down there. And to let a player of his ability just come forward and he's got the wind at his back and say, well, go on, have a strike. I just think they do so well for 40 minutes. It gets frustrating being an ex-Mariner. They do so well for 40 minutes. They give the penalty away. They let him have time to get a shot. Great strike, you know. Probably some people would say, well, if he's going to shoot from there, fair enough. Let him have a strike. I mean, he's hit at top bins, but he
was... Penalty killed him, didn't it? Penalty killed him on the 43rd minute. I know Mike Mulvey was very frustrated by the award. He felt it wasn't a penalty. It was outside the box. To be honest, I disagree with that. I think it was inside.
Yeah,
I think
it was a penalty.
But, you know, whether or not, they should have been able to refocus and lift again in the second half, and they just didn't take it on second half. Sydney were much better. Yeah, the wind probably played a part. I'm sure Steve Corica gave them a few choice words at halftime because they were awful in the first half, Sydney. But they're just not able to you know, put in a full 90 minutes at the moment, the Mariners. They conceded two injury time goals in the previous 2 weeks, and again, they weren't able to kick on second half. They just need a win, any sort of a win, to get some confidence.
Well, maybe on Friday night, as we said, huge game against Western Sydney, so that will be really interesting.
How good was Matt Simon, by the way?
Yeah.
He was terrific.
And I like the way he didn't celebrate. I don't mind that. I think it shows respect.
No, I didn't like that.
Yeah, I know you're not a fan of that stuff, are you?
Because, let's be honest, when he went from the Mariners to Sydney, when he scored, and I know he left in some circumstances, and he celebrated his heart out, and he's a coasty boy. He could have celebrated, and not out over the top celebration, but you've scored for your hometown team against one of the, you know, the premiers. Celebrate, enjoy it.
Sydney FC appreciated it. They're back at Kogarah on Saturday afternoon against Wellington. That's a chance to build some confidence because they're not playing their best football right now, and they sort of eked past the Mariners for the win. But it's a chance for them to, and hopefully another big crowd at Kogarah to maybe click into another gear. Brandon O'Neill's goal or Luke Braddon's? What would you choose? Which was the better?
Oh, do I have to choose? I thought they were both great goals.
You had to pick one.
As was the team goal for victory, that Terry Antonis, the fourth one. If I had to pick one, I'd probably say Luke Braddon because, A, he's under pressure. B, he has to take a touch and
off
has to
chest.
Be perfect off the chest. And then he has to execute in the air, whereas Brandon O'Neill has a clear-sighted goal. As Macca said, it's not closed down. It's still a great hit.
And it's off his left, which is his
And it's off his left leg. But I'd probably go with Bratton's.
if I'm going to go for goal of the week myself, I'm going for the Melbourne Victory team goal. Then I would throw Bratton second and O'Neill's third, similar reasons.
Bratton's,
Simon.
Bratton's was a beauty. He said on a podcast with Adam Peacock during the week on My Footballer's Life that he wants to become a pro golfer when he's finished football, legitimately. He said he wants to retire at 35 and then he'll give himself 15 years to make the seniors tour at 50. That strike was like a lasered five iron, wasn't it? Just perfect and dipped at the right moment into the top
Didn't
corner.
Didn't Julian Dix do that? Didn't the ex-West Ham defender? He retired and went on the pro golf circuit. I'm sure he did. Yeah.
Okay. Wouldn't strike me as a goal for Julian Dix, a rugged left back.
Yeah, well, you'd imagine he'd probably hit the ball pretty hard.
Like he smashed the penalty for West Ham and Liverpool. Anyway, big challenge for Luke Bratton coming up. 15 years is plenty of time to give yourself a crack. I've seen his swing. It's absolutely beautiful. So you never know what a story that would be, but very difficult to make the seniors tour. Anyway, more important issues for Melbourne City, a big win, and a big win for Warren Joyce. Boy, did he need that. When you think of all that was said during the week in regards to that duel with Bruno Fornaroli.
Well, he must have been ecstatic at about 1 minute and 20 seconds in when they scored their goal because, yeah, obviously he's been under massive scrutiny for this little bust-up or whatever you want to call it. But look, the team went out and performed. They were, let's be honest, they were helped in that first couple of minutes by the defending from Newcastle, and I'm sure Ernie Merrick wouldn't have been happy with that. But McGree, Turner's great strike again into the box, but that relieves the pressure straight away. Yeah. First minute, okay, we've not been playing well. We've got all this stuff going off the pitch and we go out and we bang a goal in the first minute. All of a sudden the players can go, okay, breathe. We can just sort of play a little bit now and just forget about all that stuff. So I think that had a massive impact getting that early goal. And then Brat sits up in the 43rd and bangs one in top corner. And then all of a sudden it's plain sailing, isn't it? And that just changes the whole dynamic of the whole situation the past couple of weeks. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see where that leads.
Well, for me, this issue has been localised, understandably, by the media and by the supporters. It's become about, you know, we hate Warren Joyce and we love Bruno Fornaroli. It's a fallout between the two. I think that's missing the bigger picture here. For me, the bigger picture is, what is the focus of the City Football Group? Is it about developing players and selling them on for the parent club to make money? Or is it about trying to win competitions? Now, if there's a fallout between Fornaroli and Joyce yet, that's one thing. But City still lack an identity. And the reason why this has become a touch point for Melbourne City is that Fornaroli gives them a little bit of that. He's their hero.
Yep.
He's the guy that they hang their hat on because too many of their players move on very quickly. The same with a lot of other A-League clubs. But, you know, experienced players, Timmy Cahill, Neil Kilkenny,
Brandan,
you know, players that they sort of fall in love. Harry Navio was another one. Players that they fall in love with because they've got a bit of character, a bit of personality, a bit of identity, and all of a sudden they're gone. And you saw that the crowd on Sunday was what, 6,013. I mean, they've been there for 4 years now. They should be doing better than that. Yes, Newcastle is not the biggest with respect, you know, draw card for a home game on a Sunday, but they should be up over 10,000 as a bare minimum. And the fact is that they still don't have that footprint in Melbourne. And to do that, they're going to have to try and attract some of those people that they're looking to bring into the club. And they're not doing it. And dropping people like Fornaroli, for whatever reason, they might be perfectly justified, by the way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the rumours swirling around that he didn't want to sit on the bench in Brisbane. That's why he's left out of the squad. If that's true, well, sorry, I'm with Warren Joyce. He's the coach. He has to make those decisions. So for me, it's more of a microcosm of what the bigger issue is with Melbourne City. Who are they? What do they want to be? And how are they going to tap into the Melbourne market? Do they even want to, or are they not bothered?
Yeah, but why can't you be both? Why can't you be a team that wants to win things and produce talent to send overseas?
I'm sure they would say that publicly they are.
Yeah.
But to me, it looks very much, at the moment at least, as though they're a production factory. They've said, no, we're not having marquees. We've tried that. We're not doing it. We're going to focus on young talent. They've got great young talent.
Yeah,
don't get me wrong.
Of course they do. Of course.
Brilliant young talent. They've done some fantastic things for football in Australia. That academy is superb. They're developing great players. But what about the top end? What about growing, you know, that image, that Melbourne City thing that they've done with New York City? Now, I'll give you one more. Sorry, I know I'm dribbling on. I'll give you one more example. David Villa has just left New York City and he's gone to Yokohama F. Mariners, another part of the City Football Group. Why is he not coming to Melbourne City? He's played here before. Why are they not saying, hey, come on, David, come down and give, you know, a bit of a boost? Particularly with Fornaroli on the sidelines. Yeah. Would you not be saying it, David Villa? You know, maybe he doesn't want to come. I don't know. But it just seems as though they're the third or fourth cog in that City football group wheel. You know, I think it's time that they gave some answers on that.
But the Bruno issue for now is interesting. I mean, a big game on Saturday night in Perth against top of the table side. They've had a really good win against a solid side in Newcastle. What does he do now? Does he bring him back in, or does he say, well, unless you ship up, you're shipped out? I mean, it's still going to be interesting regardless of the win. That buys him a bit of space, obviously, Warren Joyce, in terms of that battle. But it'll be a big talking point this week, and we'll wait for the squads to come out on Thursday and see if, you know, Bruno's there or not.
Well, you'd have to say that the line's been drawn in the sand now, hasn't it? So
Bruno has to come towards
it. He has to come across the line and say, well, okay, well, I'm back on this side because it's drawn and they've actually got a good result.
It's funny how the results change it. If they lose, then it's probably in Bruno's favour.
It goes the other way, maybe.
No, mate, but, you need me.
But then, you know, we're speculating on all this stuff. Is it skin folds? Is it he didn't want to play? All this stuff. But ultimately, it comes back to that stuff. Has there been a team benchmark that said we all need to be at this level of fitness or skin folds by this date, and he hasn't made it? Well, then he has to bear the consequences of that, if that's true.
Do you modify things for your great players, though? Does he have to man-manage a bit better, Warren Joyce?
The interesting thing is that Joyce hasn't actually come out and said that.
Yeah.
They've left it hanging in the air, and that's been the problem. So, of course, there's all this speculation. And, you know, even some of the players at City are saying, oh, we're not, you know, this is all media talk. Well, of course it is, because Melbourne City are not giving us anything. They're not saying what the real reason is. You can't just say, oh, it's team selection. So is anybody buying that? Are you buying that, Macca?
No, I'm not. Not if when your best goal scorer is. No.
Not even on the bench?
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a big win, so it'll be interesting to see how that changes during the week. Wellington-Perth was an interesting game as well. We'll get onto the VAR issue in a moment. What I found interesting was Mark Rudin, I think, is dealing with the politics of New Zealand football a little bit on this. He left out Sarpreet Singh and Liberato Kakache last week from the squad altogether. And a few people locally weren't happy. These are our two best New Zealand prospects. And he said they got a lot to learn and all this sort of thing. That was straight back in the starting 11 this week. So I wonder if Rudes is just a management issue for him, dealing with those sort of expectations from the locals and then trying to manage the kids as well.
Well, wasn't Kakache's father sitting in with all the directors and the owners, or isn't he part of that as well on the weekend of the game? I'm pretty sure he was sat with them. So maybe you're right. Maybe that is something that goes along that way. But look, I thought they were great, Wellington. Let's be honest. They're not sitting back. They put Perth under pressure. Not letting them play out easy from the back, which, you know, it's, rather than sitting back and saying, come at us and we'll try and break us down, they went on the front foot and said, well, come on then, if you're good enough, play out through us, and forced Perth Glory so many times to go back to Reddy, who then went long, and then you've got Taylor and Dura at the back.
Well, yep.
Two really experienced centre-halves. So I thought they were fantastic. I thought they really put Perth under pressure and stifled them. And I thought Perth were a little bit, maybe it's the long trip, but Davidson, who's looked so electric in those first few weeks of the season, he looked really flat this game. He didn't seem to have that explosiveness. He just looked a bit tired, and maybe it was the long trip, as I said, but yeah, they just didn't look themselves.
I think that's what Rudes is trying to engender, isn't it? He knows that he's not got the best squad in the A-League. So the home form in particular, with that long travel, particularly for teams like Perth, they've got to take advantage of that. And I think he's made that a priority. Let's be difficult to beat, particularly at home. And they were very good. They were so unfortunate not to win. And obviously there's perhaps a big reason why. And congratulations to Roy Krishna as well, who's got the next all-time goal scoring record for his strike on Sunday. It takes it away from Paul Ifield. Fully deserved.
The VAR issue was, for mine, I didn't see why it was overturned. Like, if he gives that in normal time, you go, oh, maybe it's a little harsh, but, you know, the foot's high. Not sure I agree with that, but I can see where the referee's coming from. It's not enough to overturn it. VAR is there for the howler, and that's not a howler for mine. And I do like how Mark Rudin played up to it afterwards. He said, oh, little old Wellington, eh? We never get the big decision. So he's trying to make it work in his favour in the future and hope one goes his way. But that did change the game. And again, the VAR was just the wrong decision.
Can I just get my scratch record out? Hang on. Here we go. Let's put the stylus on.
Here we go.
So the VAR, So are we all happy with it? Are we all happy campers? It's changed the game for the better. No referees getting any abuse. We're all 100%, you know, okay with every single decision. 100%, yeah? Nah. What a load of crap this thing is. Get rid of it. It doesn't work. It's all too subjective. The laws are too woolly. The refs are getting even more hammer than they used to. That wasn't the object of the exercise. And people are now saying, oh, it's not the VAR, it's the incompetence that used them. I mean, please. These are the same people who were crying out for this stuff only 12 months ago. Oh, it's our referees here in Australia. No, it's not. I worked for 10 years in the Premier League. So did you, Garby. Macca, you played over in England. It's exactly the same the world over. This is not a refereeing issue or a VAR issue. It's a football culture issue. We have to get away from blaming the referees for every single decision, because we all have different opinions of the game. That's the beauty of it. But once you try and make it a mechanically robotic, precision-based decision on micro frames of TV footage, you're getting into a whole world of pain, and that's where we're at.
Phil, can we just cut that, and every time there's a VAR, we just push play?
Yeah. Is that my all-time rant on
it? We can just edit it in every week, right? Without having to... We can go get a drink or something and just go and play. Step out. Okay, and we're ready to go.
It's time for a sound drop, I think.
Speaking of some audio to play, this will bring a smile to my face and many others. Apologies to Everton fans, but wow, this was electric in the early hours of this morning.
Alexander-Arnold... Up by Zuma, it's cue by Van Dijk.
Yeah, Peter Drury was at his best. What a scene. Merseyside, yeah, jumping the red half at least. Completely unexpected. You thought it was petering out to a 0-0 draw, and then Jordan Pickford makes a horrible mistake. He's just got to tip that over the crossbar and you settle for a point. But Divock Origi, a lot of Liverpool fans forgot about him. They thought he was done for on loan somewhere, didn't realise he was actually part of the squad, and he comes out of the cold and contributes a big moment like that. It's a big win for the Reds, who are giving themselves a gap now between the rest and obviously alongside Man City at the top. But
he's got a bit of a record of
Merseyside
scoring in
derby to remember. I think, yeah, he scored a big one a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Big win for Liverpool.
Tough for Everton.
Yeah, it's a tough one to take, but they just got to blame Jordan Pickford. It's just a bad mistake. The Reds deserved to win on the balance of play. They really had a lot of chances. And Everton were pretty good defensively, but you've just got to tip that over the crossbar.
Yeah, both keepers had a great game up until that point as well. But my favourite part was when, I think it was Van Dijk, actually had the strike. And as he hit it, he just turned away and disgusted himself as if to say, well, I've ruined that and the game's a draw. And then next minute, it was just unbelievable. Yeah, and... Klopp, being his usual excitable self, was not jumping everywhere, but running everywhere, wasn't he?
I think he apologised to Marco Silva after. He said, sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Yeah, but it just got the better of
him.
He said,
I can't control myself and was sprinting on the pitch. But
will he be in trouble for that, you reckon?
Maybe.
Possibly.
I'm not sure.
Possibly.
Not supposed to go on the pitch.
No.
Didn't stop Josip Gombau back in the day.
I think you realised you made a mistake straight afterwards. Liverpool have scored more 90th-minute winners versus Everton than any side has versus another in Premier League history, with five of them. So
brilliant.
It's a habit. It's a habit in the derby.
Did you say verse?
Verse. Well, I was just reading the Opta stat. So blame them. Blame Opta Joe. Against.
Isn't it versus?
I think it is versus.
What's verse?
It's a song.
Liverpool
part of a song.
Verse Everton.
All right, VAR man. I know you've been on your rant and you're a bit wound up.
He's getting nitpicky now.
Give us the spell.
Verse.
Everton. I don't care.
Haven't you heard of abbreviation, Simon?
This is Australia, mate.
It's a Gen Y thing, though, isn't it? Isn't it? Verse?
Yeah, I think it
versing?
Is.
Versing? My stepson says, who are we versing this weekend? And I'm like, what? That's not proper English. Sorry, I'm sounding like an old man. Continue.
Arsenal and Spurs was a fantastic game. I got trapped watching that. It was absolutely brilliant. Arsenal just blitzed them early and then Spurs fought back and then they blitzed them again at the end.
To and fro, wasn't it? At the start, you were thinking this is going to be all Arsenal. Then topsy-turvy world, they come back and next thing they find themselves 2-1 down. And I was just thinking, where has this come from? It was a great night, actually. Derby atmosphere, it had everything again. You know, we're talking red cards and penalties and decisions. And I actually saw someone on Twitter saying, oh, when we have VAR, we won't have these kind of things. We won't be talking about it. Garvey, I saw you say, be careful what you wish for.
Exactly what I said. They're all clamouring for it there after the Son penalty.
Yeah.
We need VAR. That would have overruled it. I don't think it would have. I actually think he might have connected with his ankle.
I thought it was a penalty. But, it was great. It was good to walk upstairs with Murray Shaw and see him not smiling so much.
I love Pochettino, as we all do, but I found his decision to leave Alderweireld out for Juan Foyth an interesting one. I mean, Alderweireld's been so seasoned and such a record campaigner for Tottenham for a while, and to leave him, they got a big game in midweek against Barcelona away, but to play a kid in Foyth over him, I thought was an interesting choice, and then Foyth made a mistake for a big Arsenal goal to go ahead.
Especially with Foyth, sorry.
You're all right.
Especially with Foyth, he had a couple of mistakes a couple of weeks ago. I sort of agree. It was like put him under massive pressure in a big game.
It's a big North London derby. Yeah. And you know what? It's a big game for Arsenal now because they're up and going under Emery. That's the big win for them since he's taken over. Early days, of course, but that's a statement victory because while they've been on a great run, early on they slipped up against the big teams. Now they've taken a big scalp.
I think Arsenal are starting to play the sort of football that their fans like as well. It's much more attacking. He's still got that base that he's trying to work on. They're still conceding goals, which will be a concern for him. But they're starting to open up a little bit. Lacazette, Aubameyang are starting to fire in lots of goals. I tell you, the player I really like, though, is Torreira in midfield. I think he's the sort of player they haven't had since Patrick Vieira, Emmanuel Petit. He is nuggety and tough. And he can also play. He's very much like Vieira Petit in that mold of play. I'm not saying he's as good as them, but he can tackle. He's a leader, but he can also link up with players further upfield. I think he's an absolute gun. Really good sign.
Well, the defensive midfielder nowadays has to be able to play as well. There was a time
it's a key position.
You know, the Makaleli player, position. You just win the ball and then give it to someone else. Now you've got to be able to get forward and contribute in a top six style club. And you see what N'Golo Kante does for Chelsea. And he wins it for the first goal against Fulham, bursts forward and lays a beautiful ball. Torreira does the same. And he almost scored a beauty in the first half and then scored the fourth in the second to seal all 3 points. So a big one for Arsenal. They got a massive game against United during the week. We'll see if they can back that up. Speaking of United, another disappointing performance by them. More misery for Mourinho. How are these stats after the draw with Southampton? I know they fought back and managed to come back from 2-0 down to get a point, but over the 13 games this season, Manchester United, in distance covered per game, they are 16th in the Premier League. In sprints per game, they are 18th. 18th out of 20 in terms of sprints per game. Opponents outrun in a game, 0 out of 13. Opponents outsprinted in a game, 0 out of 13. That is seriously damning on Mourinho.
That's interesting.
Stats.
They don't tell the whole story, but that is quite instructive. And it shows, you know, Mourinho's quote after the game at the weekend against Southampton was that he needs mad dogs in midfield. And maybe he's alluding to some of those areas. He needs players that are going to run and tackle and fight. And in a lot of games this season, they have looked rather lackluster, as though they sort of expect things to happen because they're Manchester United, instead of making them happen. there were two examples. I think Lukaku trot on the ball at the weekend. I'm not saying he means to do it, but and then Pogba, heavy first. It's like a touch of a trampoline, as Andy Keogh would say. You know, just little moments in a game that will frustrate Mourinho. And that's why they're not picking up consistent results. I mean, they've still got good players. And Sanchez is out for another month, apparently, now with this injury. So, it's not a happy camp. It's a squad that is, I think, slightly unbalanced. It's still got quality, but I go back to the original point. You know, how long has he got, really, before they lose patience?
I mean, they might be the only English team left in the Champions League by the midpoint of next week, but they're so far off the pace. Oh, sorry, City are there, of course.
Excuse me.
Apologies. I mean, you're just in a world of your own that we forget about you sometimes. But we could have Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea and Tottenham all in the Europa League and United in the Champions League, along with City, of course. But they are just so far behind it. Those stats for mine are interesting because you look at the way Arsenal now play under Emery. Look at the way Spurs play under Pochettino and, of course, Liverpool and City. It is all about high intensity. It is all about sprinting, pressing, repeat sprints, repeat press. And then when you get it back, the counter-attack has got to be swift. That's all down to sprinting and outrunning your opponents. And United are one of the worst in the league at it. That says to me, Mourinho hasn't adapted. There's a new way of, a new vogue of football that's come in, and he's still trying to play the way of 5 to 10 years ago where he was so successful and hasn't had the humility to say, well, maybe I need to adjust a little bit.
Or, as he's alluded to, he hasn't been able to get the sort of players that he wants to
he wasn't
to
happy
play
with
that sort of game.
Yeah.
Those players, Rashford and Martial, they can do that if they're coached too.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But it's a recurring cycle with Jose, isn't it? 3 years. Yeah. Every third year it seems the wheels fall off and it becomes harsher and harsher, the comments in his press conferences. And, yeah, it's like he's just said, well, I didn't get the players that I really wanted, so.
He did come up with one interesting quote that I thought had some currency. He was saying that in years gone by, you know, United were such a big club that and rich and everything else that they were able to go out and cherry pick the odd player from some of their rivals. Robin van Persie is a good example. He won them the league in 2013, I think it was. That one signing. Now he says if he goes to Spurs and says to Pochettino, right, I want Harry Kane and Christian Eriksen or one or two of the others, is he going to get those players? No chance.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
But adapt. Liverpool did.
No,
Tottenham did.
I know.
You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but remember, Liverpool have adapted this year by going out and spending an absolute bucket load of cash.
United have spent more than anyone. They've spent more than anyone
over
the journey.
But not this season. Yeah.
Right. Or City.
Maybe they'll sign Matty Ryan. Talk about league of their own. Maybe they'll sign Matty Ryan, as has been speculated, if David De Gea leaves. The Battle of the Aussies, Matty Ryan won out against Darren Moy. And there was a nice moment when Azza had the free kick, which Ryan tipped away, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a great free kick as well. Over the wall, into the bottom corner, and Matty, being Matty, as the way he is at the moment, he's saving everything, isn't he, basically? And, look, they would have had a nice little giggle about that after the game, I'm sure. But it's good to see the two of them
on.
Yeah, good win for Brighton, of course. A City not at their best, but they got the job done. Still pretty much cruised, let's be honest.
Yeah, it wasn't their best performance. Bournemouth made it hard, actually. You know, they got back to 1-1 and they're very well organised under Eddie Howe. But City have just got that extra bit of quality in most areas of the pitch, particularly in terms of goals. And I don't think you could expect any other result, really, than that.
Is Eddie Howe a manager that you think could be at a bigger club?
I think he's the next England manager at Southgate. I think he's that good.
Yeah,
seriously.
Well, Sean Dyche is battling now.
Yeah.
He had his stocks have sort of dipped a bit because Burnley
are going
struggling.
Down this year,
so I think Eddie Howe's gone past him as the next in waiting for either a big
job.
Your
team, Macca. That was good for Claret, is it? No.
No. It's terrible, actually, to see that
what's
slide.
What's your mail from back at Turf? Not good.
No one's happy at the moment.
Nobody's ever happy in Burnley.
But
it's such an exciting city that everyone will just be able to get out there and forget about their sorrows because there's just so much going on in that part of the world.
You leave Burnley alone. They do good pies in Burnley.
That's about it.
No, they don't.
Mud pies on the road, mate.
Yeah.
Let's get into the question segment. Now, this is a good one from Nathan Jones, and they had a really good discussion about this on the Wednesday podcast, the football podcast. But what's the panel's ideal format for a 12-team league if expansion does come in next season? Because that's been discussed at length. Does everyone play each other three times? That's, you know, arguably too many games and it becomes prohibitive in terms of costs for broadcasters. And then you go down to everyone plays each other twice, which is 22 games, which is not enough potentially hit a finals. It is a sticky situation for the FFA.
Is it? Because 22 games is not enough to qualify for AFC regulations, but we don't have or promotion relegation and all that stuff, which isn't supposed to be against FIFA and all that stuff. So 22 for me is way too short, nowhere near enough. 33 is probably pushing the envelope again too far. But then what do you do? Because we have the final series, if you talk about the leagues where they split after the second round and they play each other, the top teams and the bottom teams play each other through there, well, isn't that sort of like a final series anyway? So then do we double up with our final series again? So it's a real tricky one because we are a little bit different to the rest of the world. It's a hard one to...
That would be my solution to it. It looks pretty much like the only solution. You'd have to do a split after two rounds. Mm. And at least in, you know, with that format, you get up to, I think it would be 26 games. Is that right? Playing the other, four games against the other top five. So that would take you up to 26. You would have obviously the battle for the premiership, assuming it was, you know, competitive enough, but also for a home final. So there'd be a bit of competitive tension in that top five. Obviously, the bottom five would be fighting for that sixth spot. I'd also like to see some sort of punishment for 10th spot. I'd like to see the 10th club drop 12th. Into the qualifying rounds of the FFA 12th, Cup. 12th club. Before we have promotion and relegation.
So the round of 64, you mean, like of the FA Cup? The one before.
Send them in. Send them in around.
I reckon miss that altogether. Like that's punishment. You've missed out on the chance to play in the FFA Cup, and we have this actual drama towards the end of the season. This is what Andy Harper spoke about on Wednesday, and I loved it. Like, you know, it's pseudo relegation. It's not quite as damaging as that, but at least we got something to talk about for the teams down the bottom at the end.
I suppose because let's be honest, if an A League club potentially comes in around a 64, you're expecting them to win that anyway, and then. Where does it go?
I reckon just miss that altogether. Unlucky. You don't make it this season.
There's got to be something.
Anyway, ideally we go to 14 teams. Everyone plays each other twice, and that is, you know, the way we have it for a number of years. You know, hopefully they can get to that as quick as possible. Good question, Nathan Jones. It's a pertinent issue in Australian football it's got everyone talking, that is for sure. From Ben B, Edward Neb on Twitter. What's your favourite ground to commentate from, not just in terms of media facilities, but atmosphere? And then, to me, how do Aussie grounds compare to Premier League grounds? You go first on the commentary.
Oh, it's a bit in Premier League as well.
You can chime in, please.
In terms of the A-League, there's a couple. I would say Amy Park, when Victory are at home, there's always a great noise, great facilities at Amy Park as well. You're right on top of the action. Hindmarsh is very good as well, or Coopers. Probably the worst one, if we're going to go the other way, in the A-League would have been the SFS before they knocked it down because you're so far high up in the stand. I mean, the players are like ants. You can't see them. So that always made things a bit tricky. But, definitely those. And if I can pinch one in the Premier League as well, St. James's Park.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's the best.
That's fantastic.
Great stuff. In terms of how they compare, I mean, when you've got a packed old Allianz or Suncorp Stadium, you know, or ANZ's not really a football ground, but it's not too far off. It compares brilliantly. I mean, when you've got a 40, 50,000 seat stadium, it is just some of the finals we've seen in the A-League or derbies. The atmosphere, people don't want to hear it. The atmosphere is better than a lot of big Premier League games because you get so many tourists to go to Premier League games. Sometimes it can be a bit quiet. The A-League atmosphere for those big games is just unbelievable. But unfortunately, when you've got sometimes 40,000 seat stadiums and there's only 15,000 in there, it can get a bit quiet. But when you have the boutique venues like Kogarah last Saturday, it rocks, and it can compare in terms of atmosphere, most certainly with the best league in the world.
If we could have places like Kogarah, like a few roofs to keep the noise in, that's the only downside.
So there's these modular stadiums now that are apparently a fraction of the price to cost. You can build them at 15,000 capacity. Then when you fill that, you can add another 10,000, you know, take it apart, put another 10,000. Why aren't we looking at that in this country? I don't understand.
Good question, Maka.
We're spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on these big concrete structures. Why can't we scaffold it up?
Because they're vanity projects. They're vanity projects for big events. I had a conversation with, I won't say who last week, but an influential person who's involved in all this process. And I said exactly that. Why are you building a 50,000 seat? Nobody fills it. Not rugby league, not football. This is in Sydney, by the way. We have to do it because, you know, we don't know what it's going to look like in 20 years. And also we've got to have concerts and et cetera, et cetera. And I said, well, so you're building on you know, the promise of something maybe in 20 years' time and maybe getting a big event. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. Build a 20,000-seater stadium with the structures in place, and they do this quite easily, to be able to add extra tiers later 100%. If and when the demand is there. But it just doesn't seem to, I don't know, it's a mentality thing. Bizarre.
From Red, does Fox have the rights to the Asian Cup in January? Yes, we do. Every single game will be broadcast on Fox Sports and we'll be commentating plenty of them as well with our own team. So can't wait for that. And of course, the Socceroos games will be massive events. From Tommy, a Wanderers fan, can we see Daniel McBreen just pop in a random team's dressing room throughout the season wearing his mankini and rainbow wig?
I've been trying to do that for a few years now and I keep getting stopped by security.
Ha ha ha.
Stopped by the police.
Oh, maybe I need a crutches and a moon boot and I'll be able to just snoke on past.
That was your thing for a while, wasn't it? The dressing room.
Yeah,
it was,
I think that ultimately this is how I end up working here. They said, that guy doesn't mind the camera, does he? Yeah, that was it was fun times.
And your handbag.
Yeah, the handbag and the swimming in the background. It was good times. I used to enjoy the coming up with a new thing every week.
Hey, Garby. Can I jump in with one? I should have cleared this before. Yeah. My mate sent me a question. He's a regular listener. This is following.
Love when Phil just pops in. Robbie, yeah. Brilliant.
This is Phil Pryor, by the way.
Following Robbie Cornthwaite on the show last week, we were talking about the makeup of the Socceroos 11. He wants to suggest, why not moving Tommy Rogic into a 9 or a false 9. I'll be quick. Moving Rogic up there allows Moy to move to 10, his best position, and it would also get Luongo back into the starting 11, who he feels has been playing very well for QPR. He's a big QPR fan. Mm. He's Reece Langley. So, yeah, he wanted to suggest that Rogic might be our best at beating a man and creating space for a shot, you know, potentially a different way of trying to manufacture some goals.
That's exactly what Andy Harper went for with his 11. Yeah. He said Rogic is the false 9 and you get Moy in behind and then you can play Luongo with Milligan. So you get the defensive screener as well in midfield. Graham Arnold is pondering that. He's pondering a lot of options and he has got options now, and Rogic as the false 9 is one of them. So it's definitely one to watch and it's a shrewd observation. And well done, Tommy Rogic. We should have mentioned it. Another cup for the Celtic. Their 780th League Cup in a row. You actually forget it's coming around. And a League Cup final in Scotland. Celtic are playing all right. Celtic win. Tommy Rogic with another trophy. But well done. That's what he's there for. And he's got another one in the cabinet. Another question from one of our listeners, Matthew Badrov. Serious question. When is Simon Hill going to get Twitter?
Never.
I knew you'd say that.
No chance.
It's in the VAR section for you, hey?
Yeah. It's not as bad as you think, Simon. It's not as bad.
Nah.
You observe, though.
Not happening.
You observe, don't you?
Occasionally.
You peruse.
I peruse.
Stealth.
Not happening, mate.
He has a burner account, though.
But you wind people up, do you, with a false account?
No. I don't. I assure you. I've not tweeted since 2010, when I briefly had an account.
You go off your long run enough. You don't need soccer Twitter winding you up.
No.
It's not happening, mate. Never. Next question.
I think that's it for the questions. Thank you very much for your submissions. Boys, thank you for your company this morning.
Cheers,
thanks, Garby.
Thanks for having me,
Macca. Good to have
enjoyed
you on board, Macca,
yep,
for your debut. I'm sure there'll be plenty more appearances to come in the future. Thanks for listening to the Fox Sports Monday edition of the podcast. The boys will be with you on Wednesday. Muzza Shaw, Brenton Speed and Andy Harper for football. In the meantime, stay tuned to Fox Sports for all your football news. Thanks for your company.